If you don't know me, I am Mark Lohman, the associate pastor here. Who here has heard that song before? Anybody familiar with it? Show of hands. Okay, yeah, most of us. So that song, it was written by Matt Redman. Matt Redman also wrote 10,000 Reasons, which we sang about two or three songs before that. Back in the dinosaur ages, the 1990s, when I was in junior high and high school, that song was kind of like one of the songs, maybe kind of like what Oceans is for us today. But what a lot of people don't know, though, actually, is the story behind that song. And it's really, really gripping and powerful. Matt Redman was the worship pastor at a church in England back in the UK in the 90s. Very, very well-known church. And their lead pastor at that time had kind of got this nudge, this hunch, that the congregation really wasn't there to worship during their musical worship. They had kind of turned it into a concert. They were concert goers rather than worshipers. And he just felt it was kind of robotic. And so he kind of felt this nudge. He said, hey, you know what? We're going to change it up. I'm going to make a huge decision. And he got emails for this. People left the church for it. It was a big deal. And what he decided to do was that on Sunday mornings, he removed the sound system, he removed the band, he removed the instruments, he removed everything. So someone like Jason back there would absolutely probably not, would hate this guy. But here's the point. The next couple months, this community of faith, they came in, and every single song they sang in a cappella. And it was awkward. You know, Ryan did the 1 minute of silence for us. It was way more awkward for them. Some people weren't singing. It was weird. Like I said, people left the church. They didn't like it. They were used to all this kind of cool, fun music, and there's nothing wrong with good, cool, fun music. I love concerts. But for them, that's all it was. And so during this season, during this mode of the church, Matt Redman, this worship guy, he's very well known, as most musicians do. He would go back home, you know, it's late at night, he's in his room, he has his little journal out, and he's always kind of writing music, he's always writing lyrics, putting down thoughts. And one of the nights during this season, which lasted for months, well, the song The Heart of Worship came out of it. And so I just wanted to read the lyrics for us again. Jacob can put it up on the screen for us. When the music fades and all is stripped away, and I simply come, longing just to bring something that's of worth that will bless your heart. I'll bring you more than a song, for a song itself is not what you have required. You search much deeper within through the way things appear. You're looking into my heart. And then the chorus. And I'm coming back to the heart of worship, and it's all about you, Jesus. It's all about you. So, you know, a great, moving, and powerful story, right? Ever since I heard this story about 5 years ago, I've never sang that song the same. It's kind of forever stuck with me. But don't all of us kind of have this inclination that kind of bubbles up within, this proclivity to turn religious practices, in this case singing, into something other than engaging God himself? So we do this with singing, I think, all the time. Think about prayer. How many people do you know, much less yourself, because I've been there, I've done it before, where you pray in front of others and you try to use this sophisticated theological words like eschatological, whatever it is. You thank Jesus 20 times. And really, let's be honest, you're doing it to kind of just look good, to look holy, to look religious. And I even think for preachers, I have a suspicion that a lot of preachers, when they preach, it's really more of a showcase for them to show their public speaking abilities. So none of this is a new thing, right? Us religious people, we're pretty good at doing this. Nothing's new. Jesus dealt with the same thing 2,000 years ago. And so if you've been with us recently, we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount. We've called it the new way to be human. I mean, you could really say this is the most famous sermon in the history of the world. And there's kind of been this running strand that we've seen all along through it. And it's this crazy notion that Jesus flips the world upside down in front of the religious leaders. He gives them this new way to be human. And he does that just again. this morning in our passage. So we're going to dive right in. We kick off the chapter of Matthew 6 today. I'm going to read it out loud for us. If you're old school like me and you still like a physical Bible, we have those in the chairs in front of you underneath. If you use those, we'll be using page 678. Feel free to use your iPhone, be on the TVs behind me, all that good stuff. And as we look at this, I want you to really kind of zero in every time you hear the word reward. So Matthew 6, starting at verse 1. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. And so when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets, to be honored by others. Truly, I tell you, they will receive their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your Father, may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray, standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And we're going to skip all the way to verse 16. We'll cover the Lord's Prayer next Sunday. So verse 16, when you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others that they are fasting. Truly, I tell you, they received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Reward cards. These little things right here, right? They're everywhere. It was just about a month or two ago that I finally took the time to clean off my keychain, because I think I had about six or seven of these things. Half of them I probably used once or twice. The other half I never used at all. And so now the only one I have left is my Ralph's Rewards card. Ironically enough, literally this past week, twice people kind of jumped on my back because I wasn't using my reward card correctly. And so the first instance, I'd gone to Ralph's, hence this is the only one I have left, with my roommate. And we're getting up there. I just parked the car. We're in the parking lot. And before we even get inside Ralph's, my roommate says, you know what, Mark, I'm going to buy the groceries tonight. I'm like, dude, that's sick. I love that. He's like, yeah, I want to get all the reward points that I can get to put it towards gasoline. I said, okay, that's cool, man. If you're going to buy the groceries, do whatever you want. So we get inside Ralph's. We kind of, you know, each go our own way. We meet up in the middle. We get our groceries. We put them on the roll or the checkout stand, whatever it's called, and we begin to check out. Well, my roommate at this point gets the itch to go get some ice cream. So he goes to the ice cream aisle. He like runs over there, and I'm like kind of embarrassed at this point. There's a whole line behind us, and the lady's done checking us out. So I'm like, I'm not waiting. I feel weird. So I pulled out my Ralph's Rewards card, and I paid for it. Well, my roommate comes back right after his finish. He's like, he got mad. He was like, why'd you pay for it, Mark? Like, I wanted to use my Ralph's Rewards card to cover points for gasoline. I'm like, dude, that's what you get for not eating healthy. That's the lesson there, okay? Second thing, I had the fortunate opportunity on Monday, 6 days ago, to put $800 into my car. Both my front and back brakes went out. Literally, I was metal on metal. So not only did I have to replace the brake pads, but, I mean, the rotary, I'm not a car person, so don't mock me, but it was other metal pieces were messed up. So, you know, I call my parents. I'm a little frustrated. You know, I kind of talk it over with my dad to see if I'm making the right decision or whatever. And my mom finds out. One of the first things my mom says, hey, Mark, make sure to use your Discover card. You can really take advantage of the cashback rewards. It's like, Mom, it's like the last thing I want to hear right now. And also, by the way, the mechanic doesn't take Discover card. Thank you very much. So all of this to say, we are a reward culture. Like, these things are everywhere. So Target, I mean, I think they're kind of the last ones to adopt this. But even a year and a half ago, Target now has their red card. They're everywhere. Every store and organization has them. And I actually think they're brilliant. It's a brilliant marketing thing. And I think it's brilliant because I don't really think it actually costs the company or the organization all that much money. Right? So we get those 5% off coupons. You know, Red Robin gives you the a free burger for the month of your birthday. Kohl's probably sends you out coupons like every morning, I feel like. You know, we all know that one, right? But here's the thing, though. I know most of us, that actually motivates us to get into the store and to do some shopping that we probably wouldn't normally do. And so the store is actually making more money on you than they would otherwise. And that's why they do it. I think reward cards are stupid, though. Sorry if you designed one or something. I don't think they're of that much worth. Here's the interesting thing, though. I think us Christians and religious people, I think many of us treat religious behaviors, singing, praying, fasting, tithing, volunteering, like a social reward card. You want to get points for looking good, praying in front of others. And so we turn our reward into social approval. Served food distribution yesterday morning. You've been to, I don't know, 10 Sundays in a row or something. I mean, if you really want the big reward, not only do you show up here on Sundays, but you lift your right hand during worship. And then if you're a saint, it's both hands, and you close your eyes, and you kind of start moving back and forth a little bit. That's why Ryan's a saint. Right, and so we begin to be motivated, and we engage in these pious acts because others will see how religious we are. And don't we all just love human approval? I mean, honestly, we do. See, the problem, the question is, what do we really think of rewards? And what I mean by that actually is, what do you really want your reward to be? What does Jesus say about this? And so verse 1 of this section, Jesus starts it off, and most scholars would say, this is kind of like the summary verse. This is the thesis statement for the next 18 verses. It's this: be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father who's in heaven. And so at that time, three of the most popular kind of religious activities that time were giving money to the poor. It's called almsgiving. We can call it tithing, whatever you want to call it, prayer and fasting. And I think Jesus could have listed 10 other activities here. I don't think he's narrowing it down to just those three. But at that time, those three were of the most popular religious behaviors. And as we know, the religious authorities would abuse those. And so they would do them. They would do them to be seen by others. So not only were they hypocrites, which is an issue in and of itself, but the core problem that I think Jesus gets at here is that their heart, their motivation, the whole reason why they were engaging in these things in the first place was completely wrong. Like, they missed the point. So Jesus, kind of in this sarcastic, sassy, exaggerated manner, and I think Jesus talked like that a lot. I think we tone him down. He says to them, so when you give to the needy, don't announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues, on the streets, to be honored by others. So he's probably exaggerating here. People probably didn't keep a trumpet in their pocket. You know, they're walking on the streets to give someone money, and all of a sudden they whip out a trumpet and they start playing it, right? Okay, you're exaggerating a little bit, Jesus. Although some people do think that what he's getting at is that people would walk into the temple, they would throw coins in a bin for the homeless, and they would make a noise. And so that's kind of what he's getting at here with the trumpet. But who cares? The point is, don't be a religious show-off. Don't be like some actor who puts on a face mask to impress others, which is exactly what the word hypocrite means here in the Greek. An actor. So he says, truly I tell you, you received your reward in full. In other words, okay, you got your applause, people think good things of you, great. So a couple people think you're like this saint. Essentially what he's saying is, big deal, so what? Is that really, really what you want? And instead of operating kind of in this shallow reward system, he says this: "But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. And then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." Okay, so Jesus is exaggerating again. When you give, put your left hand behind your back and your right hand in front of you. And that's the way you should give, so that your left hand doesn't see what your right hand is doing. So I guess everyone back then would just kind of be like walking like this and putting money out. He's joking, right? He's not being serious. That'd be awkward. Maybe we should try that during our offering or something. We can all get up and kind of throw money in like that or something. I'm going to pick on Ryan. Those are like Ryan's like dance moves or something. Anyways, we have an extra like friends here, so I'm a little bit more excited than usual. And we spent the day together yesterday. It was good. Anyways, Jesus goes on to, and he follows, and he puts out the same template for the next two religious activities: prayer and fasting. And he does the exact same thing with those two things as he did with the first one. So we're not going to go into all the details here. We don't have the time, but his point is the same. Don't pray and fast in front of others to be noticed. Don't turn them into some theatrical production to show off. So verse 6, when you pray, open up a door, go into a little room, and just pray there. Verse 17, when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face. Seems a little strange, right? He's not talking about like mobile oil or something like that. It was more of like an anointing oil. It was a thing of respect and honor. In kind of today's culture, it'd be like, he'd be saying, go brush your teeth, go shampoo your hair, comb it, put on some cologne, perfume. If you're a junior high or high school boy, you spray some Axe on you or something like that. Stuff smells ridiculous. But that's his point. Okay, Jesus, we get it. It's clear. This is a pretty black and white passage, I think, right? I don't think it takes a PhD to understand what's going on here. Don't do religious things in front of others to be seen by them. Okay. One little question, though, Jesus. Doesn't the Bible say elsewhere that we should pray as a community? And doesn't that then mean that you're probably praying in front of others? Don't most churches take a tithe together? So you're tithing in front of others. I mean, there are many churches that do corporate fasts together. By the way, we're actually kind of talking about as a leadership team, maybe thinking about doing a corporate fast next Sunday. I'm just kidding. There were some blank faces. I was looking for that. Although, hey, it would be a good idea. Here's the crazier thing. Just a chapter before this, Jesus says that well-known verse. He says, "Let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." So what's going on here? Jesus contradicting himself. Do good things in others so that they can see them. Oh no, don't do anything in front of others so they can't see them. This isn't the issue, right? It's obvious. Jesus isn't literally meaning this stuff. He's getting at the deeper, the core problem. And it's something that I think us religious people get backwards all the time, just like they did back then. And it's this: they were using spiritual practices to gain social approval rather than to engage God himself. In other words, they valued what others thought of them more than the joy and intimacy that you can find in God alone. And the sad part is, they were doing this, their very motivation was for a pretty cheap, disappointing reward. A couple applauses. So did you notice the comment that Jesus makes at the end of all three of these examples? Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. Us Protestants, that's a fancy word. It just kind of means a branch within global Christianity. I think we're scared to talk about rewards because we don't want to say that then means you can earn your way to God. At least for me, I get kind of nervous about reward conversations because of that. Right? You can't do as many good things. You can't pray 25,000 times, fast, serve at the food distribution every Saturday, and then be okay with God, right? Like, that's not going to work. So let me be black and white and clear so I don't receive any emails or anything. I am not saying this morning that you can earn your way to God. And to make it even more clear, let me quote Ephesians 2, 8 through 9. For it is by grace you've been saved through faith. It is not from yourselves. It's the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. So I don't think Jesus is talking about rewards in the way that we usually think about rewards. A deserved prize for an action. I think we have to rethink what rewards mean, biblically speaking. And so there's this old, well, he's old, but not super old, dead guy, C.S. Lewis. Probably heard of him, right? If you've seen or read the Chronicles of Narnia, that's C.S. Lewis. And I think Lewis has this brilliant quote that can really help us as we think about rewards. I'll read it out loud, and Jacob will put it on the screens. Lewis says, "Indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition, and I would add human approval. When infinite joys offered us," and I love this, "like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by an offer of a holiday at the sea, we are far too easily pleased." So after this quote, Lewis goes on to explain different types of rewards. And he says, biblically speaking, what a reward is like is like how a marriage is the proper reward for two lovers. It's not that marriage is something earned by the two people in love. It's the natural progression of them being in love. And so the best thing for a couple who is in love is to get married, barring any other weird circumstances or something. They are each other's reward. The reward of being in love isn't a flashy wedding, isn't social media broadcasting your whole ceremony, it isn't what other people think you two are going to do as a couple and how you're going to change the world and all these other things. The greatest reward of being in love with someone is that person, is being with them, engaging them. So what if this was actually how spiritual practices worked with God? Spiritual practices are chiefly about engaging God himself. And when I say spiritual practices, you can say spiritual disciplines, you can just say prayer, worship, tithing, fasting, whatever it is, right? The lingo doesn't matter. Because see, if we're spending time just in prayer and fasting and tithing, just to look good in front of others, to be holy and righteous, not only are you being hypocritical, which is what most people think of the church at large in our culture, which are a bunch of hypocrites. So you're adding more fuel to that fire. But the deeper is you're actually selling yourself short from experiencing the greatest amount of pleasure and reward that you could. God himself. And so I think one of the questions for us this morning is what Christian things, what religious things do you do to be approved by others rather than engaging God himself? And I think we go to the approval of others because we forget that our approval is actually in Jesus. We think everything else is actually going to bring us more pleasure than God will. I don't necessarily think this has to be about fasting or praying or tithing. I think for us, a common issue is singing on a Sunday morning, right? So I think we all think it, we all feel it. When you're standing, it's like you kind of think about, what is a person to my right, to my left, in front of me, behind me? What are they going to think if I raise my hand? And some of us maybe do that just so that they do have a good image of us. And on the flip side, it could be the other way thing around. Man, if I sing too loud, are they going to think I'm some weirdo? If I close my eyes and move, are they going to think I'm some weirdo? Either way, the issue is you're thinking about the approval of others in the midst of an activity that could care less about that. And so for me, one of the biggest things I struggle with, I'm going to be a little transparent this morning too. So if it's your first time here, hopefully this doesn't scare you off. The biggest thing I struggle with is actually preaching. And what I mean by that is that it's this holy and righteous task, right? But if I'm honest, I think a lot of times I teach and preach and I enjoy it because I'm seeking the approval of others and I want them to like me. I want to impress people. I want people to think that I have it together. Yeah, Mari's a good, holy, righteous guy. He loves Jesus, man. He's got it all together. I'm actually just like one of the people in this passage then. I'm a hypocrite. And the deeper issue is not only am I a hypocrite, but I'm actually craving something that's actually not even really going to meet my needs. So I can get as many comments afterwards from a sermon. Oh, great job, Mark. Really enjoyed it. That just adds fuel to the fire. Because then if I receive one or two compliments, then I want three or four. After three or four, I want five or six. The bigger problem when I freak out then is if I don't receive comments afterwards, if someone doesn't tell me it's a good sermon, I'm a mess inside. I'm worrying. But when I preach for God and Him alone, when I just care about Him, intimacy with Him, engaging Him and His purposes and His kingdom, I gotta tell you, that's actually when I'm most comfortable, when I find the most joy and satisfaction and fulfillment. That's actually, so to speak, when I'm at my best. So there's a well-known pastor. His name's John Piper. He's got this famous saying. I think it's perfect for this. God is most glorified when we are most satisfied in Him. So this idea that honoring God and giving it all to Him is not at odds with you actually finding joy and satisfaction. The two go together. And so I think one of the ways to kind of do a gut check, because I've done a gut check this past week, ask yourself these questions. When you grumble, or no, do you grumble if your actions aren't noticed? Are you envious and jealous when others gain credit and are congratulated for something and you don't? Do you feel like every good thing that you do or accomplish should become a Facebook status? I mean, seriously. Do people applaud you or do they applaud God when you do something? Like, these are the things that came to light for me as I was thinking through this. And maybe you're here, and I think we all struggle with this, to be honest. I think it's just more a matter of degree. And so maybe you're here and you don't struggle with this that much, but maybe you're hearing me speak and you say, okay, Mark, you're talking about God being the greatest reward Himself and finding joy and satisfaction in Him. And you're like, dude, if we're all just honest, I don't find joy and satisfaction in God. I'm completely far from Him. I'm not close to Him. I don't get what you're talking about, bro. I get it. I think we all actually have a dark night of the soul, so to speak. There are times when we don't feel close to God. He seems super, super far away. But I think most of the time, though, I actually think that's because we aren't participating in the things that allow us to get close to Him. Prayer, fasting, tithing, serving, reading the Bible. So again, to be transparent, my prayer life has sucked the last couple months. I haven't felt that close to God. Christian lingo would say, oh, I'm not on fire for the Lord, whatever that means. Right? I get more pleasure. I would feel more of a reward if I watched a sports game or if I went to the gym to get in more shape. So I think maybe really the issue there is I don't really believe that God is the best thing for me, that if I go to Him in prayer, that's actually going to bring me the greatest amount of pleasure and reward for my life. So like I remember my days in college, man, I was way more on my knees and hands praying. And I felt God. I mean, God's not in a physical form right now, but it's like he was there. God was real. I felt him. And so I think one of the things that easily escapes us in reading this passage is that Jesus assumes the whole time that his people will actually be praying, fasting, and tithing, and singing, and fellowshipping, and reading your scriptures. If you notice, Jesus doesn't say, stop praying, stop fasting, stop doing this, just because you're being a hypocrite. Like, these things, these aren't recommendations. Like, these are staples, things that are as commonplace to us, or they should be as commonplace to us, as eating and drinking and brushing your teeth. Aspects of life that we actually need to practice to be fully human, to be fully alive. So he isn't saying, let's toss these activities out the window. He's criticizing the heart and the motivation behind them. He's saying, if you do these religious activities for social approval, it's a waste of your time. It's like one of these stupid, cheap, dumb reward cards. Yeah, you'll get something back. You'll get 5%. You'll get the free burger at Red Robin. Sure, yeah, you'll get it, but that's it. Truly, truly, I tell you, your reward is in full. But then you'll have to continue with these pious acts because you'll always need more and more approval. But the way of Jesus here, this new way to be human that he puts forward, is to engage in these spiritual practices because that's the best way of knowing God himself. It's in and through singing and praying and tithing and fasting that you get to know the greatest thing for you, the biggest reward out there, God. So I don't know where you're at today. I don't know if you consider yourself a Christian or not, you consider yourself religious or not. It's between you and God. But what I do know is that Jesus' words here drive us to take up these activities, not just to be religious, to seek others, but for direct engagement with God himself, knowing that his presence is the greatest thing for you. What's your reward? And so it's the first Sunday of the month. We're going to take communion. Judah's going to come up here. I'm going to join him. We're going to take communion as a family this morning. And so you will be seen if you partake in communion, right? So that's not the issue. But use this time to do a gut check, to check your heart. We're going to reflect on the death of Christ on the cross, forgiving our sins, and ask him, God, renew me, make me new, lead me back to the heart of worship where it's all about you. So June is going to get us started.